In 2015, almost everyone everywhere has a camera in their pocket, and images can travel the world within moments of being taken. This hour, we'll talk about how the field of photojournalism is changing in this climate. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Award-winning photojournalist David Gutenfelder has taken pictures in more than 75 countries. He's covered atrocities, conflicts, natural disasters, and culture. He spent 3 years working for the Associated Press in North Korea. I'll talk with him about his experiences and how his field is changing. Then Sarah Mercier of the Newseum in Washington, D.C., and Iowa City-based photojournalist Danny Wilcox-Frazier will be here to share their perspectives. Join the conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. The power of pictures is undeniable. In journalism, often photos can communicate a story in a way that words cannot alone. And in this day and age, the field of photojournalism is changing as rapidly as smartphone technology. This hour, we'll talk about photojournalism in the new millennium, which is the subject of a symposium being held at the University of Iowa on Friday, April 3rd. I recently spoke with award-winning photographer David Gutenfelder. He spent 20 years working for the Associated Press all over the world in more than 75 different countries, including Kenya, India, Israel, Japan, Afghanistan. And in June of 2011, he helped to create the AP's first bureau in Pyongyang, North Korea. He's now a fellow with National Geographic. I spoke with him on the phone from the airport in Bozeman, Montana. David, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Thank you.
And you grew up in Waukee, Iowa. You went to the University of Iowa. When did you start taking pictures?
I first started taking pictures with my grandfather when I was young. He was an insurance auditor, and I traveled with him in the car in the summer when I stayed with him, and he had to photograph all the little fire escapes and smoke detectors, and he would give me a little Polaroid camera and ask me to do all the work, and I took it home with me and started to make it into my own little kind of art form.
Do you remember a time when you started to really understand the power of images in telling stories?
I think I started taking pictures like probably most people. It's something you do for memory or to come back and say to the people, you know, people in your life, look what I saw. But I decided to become a photojournalist when I started to understand the power of photography, the power that it had to connect with people. The power that it had to alert people to the problems we have in our world. And that's when I started to try and use photography all over to try to do something good, not just to float through places and experience them for myself.
You started doing some photojournalism when you were in college, right?
Yeah, I did a foreign exchange study program in Tanzania when I was at the University of Iowa. And when I came back, I had a big pile of slides, and I edited them down to a half a dozen, and I walked into the Daily Iowan, which is the college newspaper in Iowa City, and that was my portfolio that I used to get a job, pictures from Tanzania that I used to convince the editors of the Daily Iowan that I should be able to cover Hawkeye football.
You mentioned studying abroad in Tanzania when you were in college. I get the sense that you've kind of always had a sense of adventure and a desire to see the world.
Yeah, I grew up in rural Iowa. I guess my view of the world was pretty limited and small from a farm where I lived in Waukee. And I always wanted to travel. And I think it was literally the first day of school at the University of Iowa. One of my professors talked about his research he had done in Africa, and I went straight to the Study Abroad Center, and I said, I want to go to Africa. And they said, well, hang on a minute. You probably need to have something to do there or something to say. And it became a purpose of mine. I wanted to travel. I wanted to see the world. I wanted to experience things for myself. And so that's why, you know, very soon after, I built everything towards trying to get out and see the world.
After you graduated from college, you ended up going back to Africa because of the Rwandan genocide. Can you tell me how that happened for you? What took you there?
it was 1994. I had come back. I had graduated. I was working for the Iowa City Press Citizen then, and I was covering local sports and local the community. And I loved the job, and it was fun and interesting. But I just felt like I wanted to do something else. And I saw images on television of the story in Rwanda, hundreds of thousands of refugees pouring over the border into neighboring Zaire and Tanzania and into a town where my roommate from Tanzania lived. And I just thought, you know, if there was ever a chance, if there ever was the right time for me to, you know, to give it a try and to contribute something, this would be it. I spoke the language. I was familiar with the area. And so I soon after packed my bags and moved to Kenya, and I was in, found myself in Rwanda just a few couple of weeks after I first got the idea.
And did you go there with a relationship with an organization, or were you entirely on your own?
I had a very loose relationship. I sent my my work around to some newspapers and to the Associated Press. I had a backpack with pretty much everything I owned in it, and not very much money. I thought that I would stay until I had to turn around and come home. I imagine that would probably not last more than a few months. But it actually lasted until about 6 months ago. 20 years I lived abroad, and I lived my entire 20s in Africa, my 30s in the Middle East and Asia, my 40s in North Korea and Japan. I thought it was going to be a short trip, and it ended up being pretty much my entire adult life.
When you were taking those pictures in Rwanda, and obviously, you know, forging relationships and selling your photos on that trip that you thought would be short, was there a moment that was a turning point for you where you realized not only can I make a living at this, but this is where I need to be? This is what I want to be doing with my life.
I think it was almost immediately when I arrived. I met other journalists. They became my community, my mentors, and I saw the difference that people could make. You know, in Africa at the time, I was covering, you know, unbelievable things, Rwanda, Sierra Leone, Liberia. And there weren't that many journalists willing and able to do it. And I looked around me and I felt like, you know, this is something that I can be useful. It's uniquely mine. And I really felt like if I left, you know, there'd be a loss. And that isn't always the case. There's a lot of journalists out there covering a lot of things. But certainly at the very beginning, I felt like I really need to be here. I really need to be here and witness this.
There are pictures that sometimes come from places around the world where, you know, horrible things are happening. And these pictures are incredibly important because they tell a story and they inform people and they get people involved. But sometimes I look at a picture and I think, how is it possible that a photographer was able to take that picture instead of helping that child or, you know, trying to insert yourself into the situation? Was that a difficult challenge for you? I mean, clearly you cared about telling this story.
Yeah, that what you described happens to a photographer, a news photographer, a lot, all the time. And you know that you're there because you want to bear witness to it and you want to show the world what's happening. And so you're trying to help in a much bigger, broader way, even sometimes in an abstract way. But then you can't turn away from the fact that you're standing there in front of another human being. So it's very common that you put your camera down and you help people. Put someone in your car and take them and give them help. There are times when there are other people who are there to help and are actually more capable of helping than you. And so then you step back and you do the job that you're there to do. But it's complicated, and it happens almost every day when you're out there in the field. Even just being there, you know, I sometimes felt like my job was just to be like a clown. Go into a refugee camp with children, and, you know, I'd slip and fall in the mud, and everybody would laugh. And I felt like, you know, just being a human being and relating to people and making them feel like there was a window to the rest of the world, that there were people out there that actually cared about them, that there were people out there, that there was some accountability, that there was someone watching, that they had a voice. And that was probably the most important thing for me the whole time that I'd been doing this job.
Can you tell me about an image that you in those early years in Africa, an image that really stays with you. I'm sure you took thousands and thousands of photos, but is there one or two that springs to your mind immediately when you think about that time?
The first image I probably took in Africa maybe would be worth mentioning. I went to Rwanda. I wanted to go to the prison where all the perpetrators of the genocide were being held. And I knocked on the door, literally knocked on the metal door of the prison, and they opened the door, and I said, I want to come in and take photos. And they said, you can come on in, but you're all on your own. And I walked in, and they shut the door behind me, and I was standing there in the huge courtyard filled with hundreds. There was not even enough room for people to sit down. They're all wearing these pink prison uniforms, and they surrounded me. It was terrifying. And there was one guy standing there with a plate of little handmade cigarettes using notebook paper and dusty tobacco. And I said to him, I'll buy a round for everybody. And suddenly I was their friend. And I ended up spending the whole day and came back the next day. And the picture that I made there on that day, that ran on the front page of the New York Times, I think that was probably an unforgettable experience and probably the first time that I had a picture displayed so prominently in an important publication like that. So it all came together for me.
You talked about establishing rapport with the people who were in that prison in Rwanda. Is that something that you developed into a skill wherever you went, the ability to establish rapport with the people that you would be taking pictures of, whether or not they were happy to have you there?
It's always that way in my profession. I don't think it matters if I'm, you know, working with dangerous people some faraway place in the world, or if I'm right here in Montana where I'm working now. It's a matter of relating to people and building trust with people, and, you know, so that they invite you into their lives, photograph them. I called a guy from Montana and asked him if I could come and photograph his hunting operation. He said, well, you'd have to come over here so I could size you up. And I drove 100 miles to see him, and we talked for half an hour, and he was very much like the people I grew up with in rural Iowa. And after a while, he'd say, well, I think you'll do. So it's really, you know, it's that's the job. Photography is the creative and the sort of athletic part of it, but 99% of it is out there meeting people and trying to understand and try to tell their stories.
David Gutenfelder is a National Geographic Fellow. He's also a former Associated Press Chief Asia Photographer. He spent 3 years working in North Korea and has taken photographs in more than 75 countries around the world. More of my conversation with him is coming up next. This hour, we're talking about how photojournalism is changing as technology and access to images changes rapidly around the world. That's also the subject of a symposium in Iowa City coming up on Friday called From Local to Global: Photojournalism in the New Millennium. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, the rapidly changing world of photojournalism. In a few minutes, I'll talk with Sarah Mercier of the Newseum in Washington, D.C., and Danny Wilcox-Frazier, a freelance photographer who's based in Iowa City. But first, more of my conversation with award-winning photographer David Gutenfelder. He is a fellow with National Geographic. He's also an Iowa native. And before beginning his work with National Geographic, he spent 20 years taking photographs all over the world for the Associated Press, including work in North Korea and Afghanistan. He still spends much of his time traveling, and I spoke with him yesterday from the airport in Bozeman, Montana.
There's a wonderful image that you took in Afghanistan, and there are three soldiers looking over a wall, sighting through their rifles, and two of them are wearing their camouflage. And one man was wearing boxer shorts and a red T-shirt. And it's just a wonderful image that really catches the energy of the moment and how off guard at least one of them was at the time that they started taking fire. And it also made me wonder, are there pictures that people have asked you not to use because they're indisposed. I mean, they're pictures that tell a great story, but you know what? Maybe I don't want to be on the cover of a magazine in my boxer shorts.
I think people get it. They want to see the reality of life. They want to see. That's why I was there. We're making choices about the war in our country. We're all casting our votes. We want to see what is really happening out there. And these are young guys that have never been out of their home state. And here they are, you know, fighting a battle in their underwear on the side of a hill.
When you were in Afghanistan, you started using your iPhone to take a lot of pictures. What was it that you have, obviously, incredible photography equipment. What made you start turning to your phone?
I've always been out there doing this as my job. And so one of the challenges is to keep the job fresh and to stay creative and to want to go out every day and make pictures. So I've always kind of kept a second camera on my shoulder. You know, I had one camera, my main cameras that were to do the job and to take the kinds of pictures that my employer or the newspapers expected. And then I always had a kind of separate camera, maybe a Sony film camera or maybe black and white or a little toy camera, and I would just do that for me. There was no pressure. It was always for me. I never planned on showing anybody necessarily. And that always kept me kind of on my toes and doing something new. And the phone was really perfect for that. It's so popular now. Everybody's got a phone in their back pocket. And so I was just carrying it as my second camera to be creative. And when I went to Afghanistan, you know, I noticed the soldiers and the Marines were taking pictures also with their own phones. They were out there on the front line. They weren't taking news pictures, not the kind of pictures I was taking, but they were taking the pictures we all take, keepsakes, the kinds of pictures that you send home to your loved ones, you know, memories, things they never wanted to forget. And so I was trying to take the same kind of pictures with my phone, the kinds of pictures that the Marines would have taken. And we ended up publishing them, and it was kind of controversial. Like, hey, what's this guy doing? These guys, you know, he's got these $1,000 cameras, and he's out there with his phones. And it's some people said, oh, this is, you know, this is terrible for the industry. We shouldn't be doing that, you know, purists. But it seems ridiculous now because everybody's doing it. And then fast forward to Instagram, and wow, I mean, it's transformed our profession. It's transformed really the way people think about photography.
When you helped to open that bureau in North Korea in 2011, you also took your smartphone along to North Korea. And not only did you use it in taking pictures, but you also used it, used the social media aspect of it with Instagram and Foursquare to actually map locations. Tell me why you did that and what your hopes were with that.
Well, North Korea is still one of the most, probably the most isolated, least understood place on Earth. And part of the reason that there's so little known about it is because there are no pictures of it. They've never allowed independent photographers to come into the country. There were no mobile phones allowed. And so it's just a black hole. So my whole hope of going there at all was to try to open a window on this country that we know so little about through photography. And then, after a while, when I was there, suddenly they said, okay, you can bring your mobile phone into the country. And then now we have a 3G phone network. And so not only could I go to North Korea, the only Western photographer who had ever had regular access to the country, but now I could go there, I could be standing on the street, pull out my iPhone, take a picture, post it to the whole world. People could comment back and forth. I created this whole discussion around the country, and it kind of validated what we were doing there. It generated a lot of attention. There was no better way to test the power of photography at that time than to be in a place like North Korea with an iPhone, sending out pictures to the world. And then I started mapping the country too. Google Maps in North Korea was a blank slate. So I felt kind of like an explorer, like we were plotting flags all over the city. Everywhere we went, we started naming streets. We started doing restaurant reviews. I kind of felt like an explorer. There's so few places left in the world that are untouched.
I'm sure that when you were in North Korea, you were being very carefully watched. I mean, were your social media efforts being monitored?
I was always traveling with a what they call a guide, which was a minder. And so it was a bit of a cat and mouse game, you know, me trying to figure out what was real and what was not real. And when it came to social media, they did see everything that I was doing on the AP Wire, all the pictures that I was, you know, publishing, they saw them. But I didn't think that they saw my Instagram account, actually, until several months into it. One day, one of the Koreans said, "We've noticed your Instagram account, and we'd like to congratulate you on the number of followers that you have." And it was a surprise to me, and I think also it was a way of them letting me know that they could see what I was doing. But they never censored me. They never said, told me to take anything down. But they were definitely keeping an eye on what I was doing.
It's fascinating. You have used your smartphone in many places around the world now to help you tell your stories. And of course, now everybody, almost all over the world, has access to that kind of technology. So many people are taking pictures, and wherever something happens, I mean, if we think about the Arab Spring, for example, you know, so many people were sending images out to the world from their smartphones with so many citizen photographers that are documenting what's going on. Does that change your job as a photojournalist?
The use of photography and social media has definitely changed my profession and is changing our profession in many ways. First of all, professional photojournalists, we were the only ones with the keys to publication. We were the only ones that had a way for people to see our pictures. And so there was a real sort of closed power to that. And now everyone can publish. I mean, if you've got followers on Instagram, you've got your own circulation. It's very powerful, and there are lots of people who are not professionals that have that kind of reach with their photography now. And that's difficult for some professionals. The balance of power has kind of shifted a lot, and it's had an impact on the financial health of our traditional media, of our newspapers and our magazines. So it's really changed a lot. We've always had, I guess, disruptions or upheavals in our business, and a lot of photographers see these things as real problems, real roadblocks. And that's the point where they stop being relevant, or they stop pushing forward. And then there are other photographers, and I feel like I'm one of these people that I've always seen them as opportunities, because I was just want to be creative. I started shooting with my phone because I wanted to do something new and fun. I was doing it out of love. And so I have an outlet for those pictures. And the other thing I would say is that so many people are photographers now, and it's really elevated the visual literacy or people's understandings of photography. What makes a great picture? What's the power of photography? I think it's become just a lot more commonplace for people to be thinking about photography. This is the most visually active culture we've ever had.
But at the same time, it's made it a lot harder to get paid for a lot of photographers.
I think so. I think, you know, some photographers have worried, you know, about the ownership of their pictures. If there are just so many pictures out there, what has that done to the value of a photographer who is used to working in a traditional way? But I find that the positives outweigh the negatives.
Now, for the last 6 months, you've been a fellow with National Geographic. You're accompanying scientists. You get to go to some places or see some things that most of us never get to see. What have your assignments been like for the last 6 months?
This is kind of a homecoming for me. I was away for 20 years. I've just moved back for the first time. And this is the first story I've ever done in the United States. So just photographing Americans has been a new and interesting challenge for me. And on top of that, I'm driving around Yellowstone National Park. We're doing a story to coincide with the centennial of the creation of the National Park Service next year. So, you know, I'm with biologists flying in helicopters as they collar wolves, and I wake up in the morning and there are bison standing in the driveway of the house where I'm living, and I have to wait for them to honk the horn, wait for them to get out of the way so I can get out on the road. It's been a really amazing kind of American homecoming for me, and kind of it feels like, because of Yellowstone's history, because of the wildlife that I'm photographing, I kind of feel like I've gone back to, you know, it's the sort of perfect restart point in America.
Well, David, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Thank you very much.
David Gutenfelder, he is a photographer and an Iowa native. He'll be in Iowa City this Friday as part of the symposium From Local to Global, Photojournalism in the New Millennium. My next guests will also be a part of that event. Sarah Mercier is clearance manager and broadcast productions manager at the Newseum in Washington, D.C. This is also a homecoming for her as a graduate of the University of Iowa. Hello, Sarah.
Hi.
Thank you so much for being here today.
Thanks for having me.
And Danny Wilcox-Frazier is here today. He's a freelance photographer based in Iowa City. His work includes the book Driftless, Photographs from Iowa. We talked about that on the show not that long ago. Welcome back to the show, Danny.
Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you for being here. And I was just talking to David Gutenfelder about how everybody has a camera in their pocket. So now we have, in this day and age, we have such a huge number of images available. And of course, they can be visible to so many people on Instagram, on Facebook, in so many different ways. Sarah, why don't you start with that? Just this huge number of images available. How do you feel like that is changing the news business?
I mean, the visual language, because of that, you know, David kind of mentioned, it's gotten so sophisticated, you know, and as a person at the museum who is always looking for the media that we're going to use to tell visitors these stories, I mean, we have almost an endless amount of choices from all kinds of places. They can be journalists, they can be citizens. I mean, even now, surveillance footage is woven into the fabric of modern news stories. So, you know, it gives us a huge range of storytellers to present things to our visitors. And it's very important. It's really elevated the whole conversation.
Well, and Danny, from your perspective, as somebody who's out there taking pictures and hoping that people are going to pay you to take pictures, how do you see all of those images as changing the environment?
Well, it's this mountain of information has to be dealt with. I think the most important part of it is the editing side. It's our industry like embracing that aspect. Someone like, say, Paul Moakley, deputy director of photography at Time magazine, and it's not just still photography, it's video as well. Paul was able to make a video that recently was recognized in the World Press Photo Award, the multimedia contest. And what Paul did is he interviewed Ramsey Orta, who's the individual who made the video, the phone video, of the incident with Eric Garner being choked, eventually died by when he was choked by police. Going back and contextualizing that video, helping everyone understand, you know, the importance of it, but also, you know, the broader picture, the big picture that we all need to understand to, you know, deal with the emotion that I mean, it's a very troubling video when you watch it. But then as we continue on with the story, you know, we further understand, you know, the difficult position that at times police are put in. You know, photos from Ferguson of a police line, you know, police with assault rifles, no different than our soldiers in Afghanistan, M4s, facing off with peaceful protesters. You know, that image, I remember seeing it, and it was just so strong. I was like, what is going on? What is going on in America? This is Ferguson. This is like not far from right here in Iowa City. And you know, but at the same time, we want our police to be able to respond, say, at the Mall of America, where recently, you know, there were concerns over terrorist attacks. We want our police to be able to respond into a situation with the, you know, the arms, the means to, you know, if there was a Westgate Mall, the attack, and of course, Nairobi, Kenya, if there was an attack, to be able to have what they need to take on those kinds of individuals.
So you feel like with journalism, part of what has changed is that we need professionals to sift through that material and help us put it in context and help us understand it, because there's just so much of it.
Absolutely. I mean, that's the most important thing. I remember I was speaking to graduate students and undergrads at the University of Missouri when I was judging the Pictures of the Year International contest a little over a year ago. And some of the graduate students asked me, you know, what's the industry really need? And what I said was, we need more great editors. We need people to help make sense of all this information. And, you know, I hope I got through to some of those students.
Well, and Sarah, one of the things that those editors also have to deal with is that not only is there so much information out there, but it's pretty easy to manipulate photos in this day and age. We all have access to the kinds of software that makes that possible, right?
Oh, yeah, definitely. And there's no... When the speed of the news cycle is so fast, you know, there are plenty of organizations that, you know, they may choose just to tell their visitors, we're just getting this in. We haven't verified it yet, but here it is so you can see it. You know, and so in something like the Boston bombings or, you know, even some things coming from Ferguson, they're on the air saying, like, look, this is what I see on Twitter. This is a video, you know, from wherever. And it isn't always correct.
Right.
You know, and they aren't intentionally misleading their audience. But at the same time, it's like, it's already out there. It's happening so fast. We just have to tell you what we know about it right now. And
we're going to take a short break, Sarah. We'll be back. We'll talk more about that in just a moment. Sarah Mercier of the Newseum in Washington, D.C. Danny Wilcox-Frazier is a freelance photographer who's based in Iowa City. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about the rapidly changing world of photojournalism. There's a symposium coming up on Friday in Iowa City. It's called From Local to Global, Photojournalism in the New Millennium. And my guests are going to be a part of that event. Also, many other photojournalists coming in from around the world to be a part of that event. Sarah Mercier is clearance manager and broadcast productions manager at the Newseum in Washington, D.C. Danny Wilcox-Frazier is a freelance photographer based in Iowa City. And Sarah, just before the break, we were talking about photo manipulations. And, you know, you were saying, of course, reporters, news organizations aren't trying to fool people. They don't want to present information that is not true, but they also have this need to be responding up to the minute, or people will tune away and look elsewhere. What kind of resources do editors have to know when photos have been manipulated?
I mean, the software for detecting that kind of thing is catching up. So, you know, I know some agencies out there have a way of sort of flagging electronically those sort of trademark things, like maybe it's been cloned, or maybe there's been global or local adjustments. And, you know, there are sophisticated ways to tell so they can have a human being sort of take a look at that. You know, and it's photo contests are like another way that more attention has been brought to that issue. You know, people are asked to submit raw photo files along with their edited contest submissions. And sometimes those get evaluated at the end and the judges say, you guys did too much to those and we don't think they're qualified anymore.
That's fascinating. And Danny, what are your thoughts about that? Because, of course, as a photojournalist, you want to present the photo that is exactly what you wanted it to be. So, I mean, photojournalists use manipulations, too, without changing the context.
Yeah. It's a really difficult debate. This year, 20% of the finalists at the World Press Photo Competition were disqualified for either over-processing or manipulation, which, as Sarah was just talking about, is removal of content. You know, adding content, we can do just about anything anymore. But that's always been around. There were darkroom techniques that people did, sandwiching negatives, bringing two negatives together to, you know, basically the equivalent of clone something into your photo. Now, you know, we do that with Photoshop digitally. You know, it used to be able to be done in the darkroom as well. We can go too far. There is authorship. You know, there's that visual consistency or style, if you will, that a photographer works to develop. And, you know, that there's all kind of processes. And within photojournalism, you know, it's defined what is acceptable and what is not, but processes to, you know, make a photo appear more dramatic, darken things down, burn, what, you know, we used to call it burning in the dark room, where we actually sat there with pieces of paper with holes cut out in the middle, and you'd add more exposure mm-hmm. to a certain part of the print. You know, so there's rules in place within photojournalism. You move into documentary photography, and then, of course, fine art photography, and these are all, you know, out the window. But, you know, that precious place that photography, news photographs specifically, has within journalism, it needs to be guarded. We need to make sure that these images are as factual as possible. It's a subjective act. I mean, you know, let's just be candid. It's a very subjective act. You know, I decide what I crop out of my photo.
Right.
That's as much part of the process as what I decide to put in the frame. But, you know, for me, it's all about openness, honesty, compassion. Those are words that I really, you know, grasp and try to advance in my own photography.
Now, there are a lot of great amateur photographers out there. But for every one, like, amazing photo that you see on Flickr or on Facebook, you also see dozens of other images that are either subpar or just basically terrible if you're looking at them with the eyes of a photographer. So what is the difference between what you do when you take a photograph, or as many photographers like to say, make a photograph, as opposed to what I might do when I want a picture of that, click. So, Danny, can you shed a little light on that for us?
Well, it's voice. It's voice. It's your concern over, you know, these issues. I, you know, early in my career, I left the U.S. too. David and I are both from small towns. I'm from LeClaire, Iowa. David's from Waukee, Iowa. You know, I had that desire to escape, and but when my wife and I returned to Iowa City for her to go to graduate school, I remember starting to photograph in rural Iowa, and I remember thinking about, you know, there's no one shooting this. There's no one documenting all, you know, depopulation, you know, the economic downturn in a lot of these rural areas, just the impact of that economic shift that was happening. And, you know, I knew that for my photography to matter, for people to pay attention to it, I needed to be photographing, you know, an issue that would overtake me and my career. And, you know, that's what I've been doing for over a decade now, covering those issues. So it's that personal voice that I've developed, covering, you know, rural America that people come back to. So I'm always looking for that authorship, you know, that visual consistency. You know, I'm looking, you know, just for someone who has something to say about the world around them.
You also really like to shoot in black and white, which makes a statement as well. I mean, do you think about that?
Yeah. You know, color can often just be about itself. And, you know, black and white, it you know, I mean, right there. I'm manipulating, right?
Right.
Whether I'm using film or not, it's, you know, it's not how I saw the scene. You know, I'm seeing the scene in color. But for me, it's that emotional impact that the black and white image conveys. It's just I'm mostly concerned with the emotional landscape, not necessarily the physical landscape of rural America. It's that emotional landscape, and black and white allows me. And, you know, within I work in the most, you know, to the strictest tradition of documentary photography, and that's why I often work for editorial publications as well as a photojournalist. It's because, you know, I'm not manipulating, and I do fall within, you know, those guidelines, what we consider in our industry is acceptable within what we can do to a photograph. And whether it's digital and I grayscale that image, I make it, you know, a monochrome image, or I shoot with black and white film, which I still do. My assistant's scanning film right in my studio as we speak. It you know, it falls within those kind of confines of what we can and cannot do.
Sarah, at the museum, you tell the stories of some of the biggest news events in history, and
with so many photographs available now and so many videos available now of truly historic happenings, I often think about, you know, what if everyone had been had a cell phone camera on the day that John F. Kennedy was shot? I mean, we have that one piece of video that has been watched millions of times and analyzed to death. You know, with the work of cataloging history, how does one go about selecting the images now that will be part of that record?
It's just casting a wide net and then doing a lot of that sort of, you know, editing that I think maybe Danny was referring to earlier. We really go into depth, especially when we're looking at something that happened recently, like Ferguson or Boston. It's like, okay, well, what is this piece of material? Who took it? Who are they? Where were they standing? What were they using? Why did they do this? How did they disseminate it? You know, and so we really have to back out and sort of profile every piece of media that we're considering. And then, you know, we work with writers, we work with video editors, we work with photo editors, and all of those people really have to put their minds together to come up with, you know, a condensed but powerful and true group of things that can help our visitors look back on something significant that happened and see how it was covered, you know. And it was interesting. We did, you know, a JFK exhibit. I went to the National Archives. I photographed the Zapruder camera, and it's, you know, the odds of something like that happening then were so small that he did it, you know, right. And then you compare it to an event like Boston, and there are thousands and thousands of things to go through. You know, for us, it makes the story a little bit richer.
And more overwhelming.
And more overwhelming. And, you know, some of it you just have to treat as these people were like eyes and ears because, you know, they were in that place. The professionals, like Danny, weren't there quite yet. So, you know, we might insert them in a moment where, yeah, they did just click a button on their cell phone, but they happened to be right there as that thing was happening. So we know that it isn't a composed, you know, person with a special eye and a special mind like Danny is doing that. You can easily tell the difference. And they tell, you know, different stories, but we're able to kind of combine them and layer them. Like maybe if you were on the scene, this is what you would have seen. It would be like that person's cell phone picture a little bit. And then, you know, some other professional from a news agency arrives and they're able to tell, you know, a more sophisticated or more emotional or more powerful sort of thing.
And of course, I mean, talking about Zapruder, the role of citizen journalist is not entirely new. It's just that there's so many more of them, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's the Zapruder tape and there's an image from the Oklahoma City bombing that ended up winning a Pulitzer. Can you tell us a little bit about that one?
Yeah, sure. I mean, it was basically like a bank employee who was an avid amateur photographer. And so he happened to occupy this space where, you know, he had nice equipment and film available and he was in the right place at the right time and was able to, you know, make that picture of a fireman with a child in his arms that, you know, became one of the most iconic photos from that event. And so there was a lot that kind of lined up for him to be able to do that. And it's not like professionals didn't do their job. He just sort of had that special space and was able to accomplish that.
And we are seeing news organizations really changing their reaction to these kind of photos as well. I mean, we see them printed now in the New York Times, for example.
Yep. They're really woven in. They're just like another level as all these media sort of converge, you know, on the air, on a broadcast network. They'll talk about everything from, you know, the headline of a New York Times article that's text to a citizen video to, you know, something on a Reddit feed to, you know, whatever they're gathering that they think is saying something. So it all kind of, there are these points where all these different mediums that used to maybe be kind of siloed and separate they come together. They're all part of everyone's fabric of consuming the media today.
Now, of course, when a magazine or a newspaper publishes images, they have a limited amount of space. When a magazine or a newspaper or another organization publishes images online, they do not have a limited amount of space. Danny, when you see people publish things online, do you ever think you've actually included too many photos with this story? Do you think that sometimes the story gets lost among the images?
Yeah, I deal with that all the time with students. I'm an advisor. When I'm not on the road, I advise at the college newspaper here in Iowa City, the Daily Iowan. And, you know, young photographers, everything they take is great. I mean, I had the same issue, you know. It was like you have to learn, you know, to edit tightly. And, you know, there are times where there's, you know, and you know, I see an essay online or I'm working with a student. It's just it's so loose that you lose that narrative. You lose that flow, the ability to, you know, really understand what the photographer is trying to convey with that series of images. But it's
and you lose a half an hour looking at them, too.
Yeah, especially if they're large and, right. You know, you have a slow Internet connection like me at home. And but it's such an amazing time. It's such an amazing time in photography. You know, because of you know online publications, you know, visual storytelling has never been more relevant. Has never been more you know accessible. And you know, I can't help but be you know excited every single day that I work as a photographer. And you know, everything Sarah was talking about, it's like we need everyone to come together to you know. To help us understand all of this visual information. And then, you know, what is a great photograph? A great photograph, you know, creates questions, right? It you know, it evokes this emotional response out of a viewer. And if a photographer, and I don't care if it's professional or amateur or, you know, just someone who happened to be in the right place at the right time, if a photograph is great, it then forces people to go and do work on their own, to try to better understand that situation, to learn from that image, to learn from what is happening around us. And, you know, we're at a time where we can, you know, put so much out in front of everyone and learn so much from photography. And, you know, it's exciting.
And Sarah, we've been talking about how much things have changed and you know, we're not going to go back. Everybody has this technology in their pocket. Where do you see this taking us in the future?
Oh, man, that's a great question. And I don't really know. I agree that it's, you know, an extremely exciting time. And it's when I reflect on, you know, the impact of digital photography on photojournalism in this global photo community in the United States, it's hard to separate it from, you know, the collapse of the financial model of their industry that also happened to kind of coincide with a recession. And I think that caused a lot of anxiety that wasn't necessarily related to the technology itself. And so as things kind of even out and organizations advance and figure out how to deal with technology, it's only going to get better for the people who are so creative and out there and breaking these barriers. You know, it's only going to get better.
And we have seen images, you know, organizations that have fired their photographers and then comparing different newspapers to papers that have photographers. I mean, do you think that we will see a little bit of a backlash, of an understanding that actually having people who understand this work is important on your staff, Sarah?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's rough. It's been really, 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 really brutal. I mean, these people, newspaper photographers were the backbone of photojournalism for many, many years, and they've just had the rug ripped out from underneath them in this terrible way that, you know, coincided with this change in technology. And so coupled together, I mean, I empathize with these people. It's very difficult. But at the same time, you know, Danny and David and many other photographers out there are finding ways to tell their stories. They're using new platforms. They have more ways to get their work in front of important people's eyes, everyone from book publishers to, you know, fantastic online blogs like Lens in the New York Times or Proof in National Geographic. And they can take their viewers behind the scenes with them.
Sarah, thank you so much. Sarah Mercier of the Newseum in Washington, D.C. Danny Wilcox Frazier, thank you.
Thank you for having me, Charity.
Danny Wilcox Frazier, freelance photographer based in Iowa City. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.